Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James West, and today I'm joined by Jerry Gershenhorn, who's the Julius L. Chambers Professor of History at North Carolina Central University. We'll be discussing Gershenhorn's 2018 book with the University of North Carolina Press, Lewis Austin and the Carolina Times, and the book is soon to be released in paperback. Gershenhorn narrates the story of the long black freedom struggle in North Carolina from a new vantage point, using Austin's life and the history of the Carolina Times to shed new light on the vitality of black protest and the black press in the 20th century. Hey, Jerry, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to be with you.
To start off with, would you be able to say a little bit about Lewis Austin, the main figure in your book, to our audience? Who is he? Why is his life important?
Sure. So Lewis Austin was the publisher and editor of the Carolina Times, which was the black news weekly in Durham, North Carolina. And he published a paper from 1927 to 1971. And he used the newspaper essentially as a vehicle to fight what I call the long black freedom struggle in North Carolina and really throughout the nation. He was definitely an advocacy journalist. He saw the newspaper not just as a business, which was the case with some other black journalists, but he prioritized focusing on the black freedom struggle, and he wanted to challenge racial segregation, racial oppression, and racial injustice in really all ways. And in doing so, it created a lot of hardships for him because it's difficult to run a newspaper, which is, based on advertising as well as subscriptions, when a lot of times he was alienating his advertisers, both black and white, because he was very quick to criticize both black and white officials and, leaders if he didn't think they were pursuing racial justice. So he's an incredibly important figure. And one of the things I was able to do in the book, I think, because he published and edited the paper from the 20s through the early 70s, is use the newspaper and the story of Lewis Austin and the newspaper as a way to track this long freedom struggle by African Americans going back to the period 2 or 2.5 decades before the Brown versus Board of Education decision and the Montgomery bus boycott, which is usually the point at which popular versions of the civil rights movement start in the 1950s. But clearly, African Americans were fighting against racial injustice well before that. And many historians prior to myself have, made the same point that this freedom struggle began decades before. Many have looked back to the Depression era. And so in doing so, I was able to kind of do that. And also the movement goes beyond the 60s. Popular versions used to say that the movement ended with the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, but the movement went beyond that, even though, of course, that was a terrible blow to the movement. And Austin, and then his successor, his daughter, took over the newspaper in 1971, continued to use it as a vehicle to fight for racial justice in the 70s and beyond.
So his paper, The Carolina Times, for listeners who perhaps not too familiar with the black press, names such as the Chicago Defender or the Pittsburgh Courier might potentially be familiar, but the Carolina Times probably isn't. How influential is the Carolina Times? Is it more a regional paper, or does it develop a national audience? What kind of differences or similarities might there be in its focus and orientation compared to more well-known black papers of the period?
Yeah, absolutely. The Defender and the Courier had much more of a national audience than the Carolina Times. But another thing is what I want to do is highlight the role of the Southern black press. I mean, some people are more familiar with the Northern black press and clearly the Defender and the Courier and the Baltimore Afro-American and maybe the New York Amsterdam News had a larger circulation. But the Southern black press, including the Carolina Times, was very important in challenging racial injustice. And although the paper was printed in Durham, it was read widely throughout the state. And at various times, it was published in various places. Sometimes there was an edition published in Charlotte, for example. So it was very important in the state of North Carolina, not just in Durham. And as others have pointed out, although the circulation might have run from, I think it may have peaked at 20,000, 15,000 to 20,000, these newspapers were passed around and read by, by many individuals. So one newspaper could have been read by five. So its reach was much further beyond its, circulation numbers. So I think it was incredibly important in North Carolina. Austin himself was well known in the black community and among black leadership and black journalists throughout the country. He spoke in many cities in the Northeast as well as in the Southeast. So I think he had a pretty broad influence, but the largest influence would definitely be within the state of North Carolina. I kind of situate him as one of the key leaders, if not the key leader, in this long black freedom struggle, if we take it back, at least two decades before the 50s.
And North Carolina is a state that you're obviously very familiar with. How important was that context in terms of having a regional familiarity? Did that allow you to develop certain aspects of the book, perhaps more than it might have been if you were someone who was less familiar with the political and cultural context of North Carolina?
Yeah, I think that was very important. I've taught North Carolina history at North Carolina Central University for probably close to 20 years now. And I've published other articles, some prior to the book, about Lewis Austin, but also about other aspects of civil rights struggle in North Carolina, about education, black education in North Carolina. I'm fairly familiar with the history of North Carolina and in particularly African-American history in North Carolina and the role of race. And so that was certainly very helpful in putting it in context. And, I had to kind of, in terms of researching the book, I had to look at a lot of different archival collections. One of the challenges in writing the book was that there is no Lewis Austin collection of papers. I mean, I don't have a manuscript collection. There's no archival collection of Austin's papers. When I wrote my first book, it was about an anthropologist named Melville Herskovitz. I had over 100 boxes of correspondence and other records of Herskovitz's to use. But in this case, the major source was the newspapers themselves, the editorials, as well as the articles that were reported on. But I was able to find a lot of information about Austin and people that he was involved with in some way, either working with or criticizing, by looking at collections of political figures, black leaders, the NAACP papers, things like that. Yeah, Austin had a huge impact in North Carolina, and it was very helpful to have this context of North Carolina. The other thing is that one of the things I try to do in the book is tell the story of this freedom struggle in North Carolina, using the paper once again as a vehicle for that. And although Austin once again was headquartered in Durham, he reported on the entire state. And he reported extensively on Eastern North Carolina, as well as the Piedmont, He was from Eastern North Carolina. He's from Enfield, a very small town in Halifax County. I think fair to say that most African Americans during much of the run of the paper still lived in Eastern North Carolina in very rural settings. And those areas were incredibly oppressive toward African Americans. Some civil rights activists commented that Eastern North Carolina was worse or as bad as Mississippi in terms of its racial oppressiveness toward Black people.
So let's dig into that a bit more in terms of Austin's background. So you mentioned he's from Halifax County, and there's very much this culture of racist violence that's part of that history. But then you also have, in some counties, majority Black communities, and that leads itself to a certain degree of business power or at least opportunity. So how does Austin's experiences in Halifax County, how does that feed into his later role as a businessman and as a newspaper editor?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a few levels for that. I mean, his family was very important in his upbringing. You know, I maintain that his family, and particularly his father, had a great influence on his unwillingness to accept racial injustice and to accept inequality. Halifax County itself had a long history of Black land ownership going back to the Reconstruction era, and also during Reconstruction, and even a little beyond the Reconstruction era into the late 19th century. There were Black political officials. Now, Austin wasn't born until 1898, which was the year of the Wilmington Race Massacre, incredibly violent white supremacist attack on African-American politics and African-Americans in general, in which many Blacks were killed in Wilmington. So he was born in a period of, you know, what the historian Rayford Logan called the nadir of African-American life post-emancipation. But the history of Halifax County did provide at least a legacy of Black business, Black farm ownership, and Black politics. And his father would have been growing up during that period. Austin told stories about his father, who ran a barbershop for whites and refused really to accept disrespect. In a period in which it was rare for African Americans to be addressed or African American men to be addressed as Mr. Austin, for example, that was the case with his father, whose name was William Austin. So, and he taught that to his son. There was one story that was told to me by Lewis Austin's daughter and his grandson, that when Lewis Austin was a young guy, maybe 7, 8 years old, he was in his father's barbershop. And he saw a bunch of some of the older kids going up to white customers and walking up to them and saying, shine, Captain, shine, you know, trying to make some money by shining some of the white customers' shoes. And Austin mimicked them and said the same thing. And his father immediately stopped in the middle of shaving a white customer and reprimanded Lewis, told him, no man is your captain. And, you know, you should never treat somebody as better than you. And that was a lesson that he learned. And I think it something that he followed through the rest of his life. He was, you know, refused to accept inequality. He was a very religious man. He was a Christian, came from a strong Christian background in the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And he believed that everybody was equal before God, and that that guided him. So I think, you know, his childhood had a big influence on him, as well as where he was from.
So Austin, he goes to the National Training School in Durham, and then he ends up working for a Black insurance firm in Durham. So how does he go from working at the insurance firm into owning and publishing the Carolina Times?
Yeah, so Lewis Austin came to Durham to go to the National Training School, which was the predecessor of North Carolina Central University, in about 1917, so during World War I. And at the National Training School, he met some of the people who would also become, you know, major Black businessmen. There was a strong Black business community. North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance had been started in 1898 by John Merrick and Aaron Moore. and had been they'd been soon joined by C.C. Spaulding, who became was really the longtime president of the North Carolina Mutual and of other related black financial businesses like the Mechanics and Farmers Bank, which was founded in 1908. And Austin, after graduation, worked as in insurance for the North Carolina Mutual. And at the same time, he around the same time, he was also working as a sports reporter for the Standard Advertiser, which was the name, predecessor name of the paper before it became the Carolina Times in 1926, which was the year before Austin bought the paper. So Austin was working both in insurance and as a reporter. And the paper had been started as the Standard Advertiser in 1921 by kind of an itinerant actor, decided to get into the newspaper business. His name was Charles Arendt. And he only ran the paper for a year because he had been running some investigative pieces on crime, African-American crime. He was known as, he was called in the newspaper a vice lord. This guy took exception to some of the things Arendt was writing about, and they ended up in a shootout. And apparently they shot each other almost at the same exact time, and they both end up dying. Subsequent to that, there were several editors who ran the paper. And some of the people, black business people, felt that the editor who was running it at about 1926 was really not up to the task. Some said he was somewhat of a drunk. And so the vice president of Mechanics and Farmers Bank, a guy named R.L. McDougald, who Austin knew, suggested to Austin that he buy the paper. And he gave a loan to Austin to purchase the newspaper. So Austin bought the paper in 1927. It's hard to know a whole lot about what the paper was doing in the late 20s and even into the early 30s, although I was able to ferret that out through other sources, because the first newspapers that were microfilmed, or at least those that are still available, were in 1937. So the microfilm version of the newspapers of the Carolina Times starts in 1937. So from 27 to 37, that's another 10 years. I was able to get, you know, snippets and bits and pieces by looking at other newspapers, which sometimes reprinted stuff that Austin wrote or articles from the Carolina Times or some of his editorials. And there were also people were often researching about Austin. So the stories were told about Austin. There was a really excellent dissertation that was done by a sociologist named Harry Walker. And he interviewed Austin extensively. And Austin talked about some of the things he was involved with in the late 20s and early 30s.
So from those snippets and the bits of information you've been able to gather from the early period of Austin's ownership, how quickly is he able to remold the paper into his own vision of black protest or the role of the black newspaper?
It seems to me that it was pretty quickly, although I don't have that much on the late 20s, but by the early 30s, he was very active in voting rights and voter registration campaigns and forming organizations and filing lawsuits. In 1932, he helped form the North Carolina Independent Voters League and organize a statewide conference. And that year was really a pivotal year in Durham and in North Carolina in terms of the Black freedom struggle, because Austin and others, there was another prominent leader at the time, a guy named Robert McCance Andrews. Andrews was an attorney, and Andrews and Austin worked together to try to promote black voter registration. And as many people will know, African Americans going back to the Reconstruction era had been Republicans, because the Republican Party was the party that supported the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to abolish slavery, grant equal citizenship for African Americans and voting rights. But by the 1930s, in the midst of the Great Depression, the Republican Party hadn't really done much for African Americans and had been moving away from overt support for African Americans' rights. And under Herbert Hoover, President Hoover, the Depression was getting worse and worse, and unemployment was rising, and African Americans were disproportionately suffering. So Austin and Andrews and some others decided that it was time for African Americans to reject the Republican Party and try to influence you know, the election of more candidates who were more sympathetic to African Americans. By this time, the South was essentially a one-party region. Democrats dominated. Whoever won the Democratic primary would win the general election. The Republicans really had almost no power. In North Carolina, in 1900, the literacy test, poll tax, and grandfather clause had been passed, which had pretty much eliminated Black voting. But in 1920, the poll tax was repealed in North Carolina, and African Americans in the 1920s started to make some moves to increase Black voter registration. So in 1932, when Austin, and he was also supported by the Black editor of the newspaper in Raleigh, a newspaper called the, then it was called the Carolina Tribune, today it's the Carolinian. It was edited by a guy named Hugo Fontelio Nanton, and Nanton had worked for Austin prior to that. So Nanton, Austin, Andrews pushed for Black voter registration as Democrats, and they got tremendous pushback from people like Josephus Daniels, who was the editor of the Raleigh News and Observer, the white daily newspaper. And Daniels wrote editorials daily attacking Black voter registration, and especially Black voter registration in the Democratic Party. And he invoked the 1898 Wilmington Race Massacre, which he had helped to, if not promote, he definitely promoted white supremacy and attacks on Black voting, and certainly did not oppose the use of violence against African Americans at that time. And, you know, I would say that, you know, the level of white opposition to Black registration in the Democratic Party was gives you a good sense of how significant this was and how threatened whites felt by the actions that Austin's and others were taking. And they did succeed in registering, you know, African-Americans, and the numbers increased during the 30s. In 1935, the Durham Committee on Negro Affairs was formed, which became a very important organization in terms of Black voter registration, Black political influence, and, you know, challenges to racial injustice. And Austin was one of the founders of that organization. In 1933, he was one of the architects of the first legal challenge to segregated higher education in the South, when he, along with Black attorneys Conrad Pearson and Cecil McCoy, were able to find an African-American student who wanted to go to pharmacy school. There was no pharmacy school at any of the Black schools in North Carolina, but there was one at UNC Chapel Hill, which was all white. And so they filed a lawsuit to desegregate UNC Chapel Hill in 1933. And that was really the first step toward the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the landmark decision that mandated desegregated public education.
And Austin isn't just involved in political organizing or attempting to get Black elected officials into office. He also actually wins an election himself. He becomes a Justice of the Peace in Durham. And this is celebrated by the Black newspapers as a really significant moment in terms of Black electoral politics in North Carolina. So how exactly does Austin manage to get elected, and what is his role and influence?
Yeah, I mean, that was it was kind of a clever move by Austin, and it was actually him and a friend of his named Frederick Watkins, who was kind of the self-styled movie king. He was an operator of Black movie theaters in Durham and actually in other parts of North Carolina as well. And in 1934, they were both elected justices of the peace. And at that time, the rule for the elections was there was like a quota. So there had to be a certain number of justices per a certain number of people in a city. So apparently the quota was unmet. So right before the filing deadline, Austin and Watkins filed for the positions. And because they filed so late, there was no opposition. So that's how they were able to get elected. The Pittsburgh Courier said that their election, and they were elected as Democrats. They said this was the beginning of the New Deal in the South, because I'm not sure if there were other cases. There may have been some, but it was very rare for an African-American to be elected as a Democrat or almost anything in the South at that point. I mean, it would be another almost 20 years before the first African-American would be elected to the city council, for example, in Durham. But they were elected, and he served as Justice of the Peace. And so he would handle you know, traffic cases and stuff like that. One time there was a traffic accident, and the driver who was, at fault in the accident, he appeared before Austin. When he saw it was a black judge, he says, "No, I'm not going to have my case before a black judge." So Austin said, "Oh, that's fine. I'll send you to Watkins." So, of course, another black judge. So he did. He served in that position. And the first case where African Americans were elected to public office in the 20th century in Durham.
So Austin is, you know, he's established himself as an uncompromising, quite militant editor, public figure. He's also someone who, in his personal life, is not willing to step back. There's one anecdote you tell. I think it's in the early 40s when a white man forces Austin's wife off the pavement, and Austin ends up punching this guy, and he has to kind of get rushed away and taken away before something else can happen to him. How does Austin navigate that role? You know, he's someone who's outspoken, who's quite militant, but also he, at the same time, is trying to protect himself and trying to keep himself and his family alive within the racist culture of North Carolina during the interwar period.
Yeah, he was often threatened. He had crosses burned in front of his house, threatening phone calls. Ku Klux Klan threatened him. And, you know, it's the question often asked me is, how did he survive in that period of, where white violence was widespread? But he did have a lot of supporters. He had people who had his back. You know, there was one case where somebody threatened him, a white individual, it's not clear who, but threatened him and told him he should leave town. And he went down to confront the individual and said, where to find me? And that night, the story was that he was in his house and he heard some noise on his front porch. And it turned out it was some of his friends who were standing guard on his front porch, and they had rifles. So he had a lot of supporters, and he did have support also among the black middle class. During this period, the black business community had a kind of certain relationship with the white business community, in which the black business community wouldn't push too hard for change. I would call them gradualists. You know, they did try to uplift the black community, but they did not challenge segregation and that sort of thing. And they tried to deal with racial tensions by negotiating behind the scenes. This was something that Austin rejected. He refused to, go along with gradualism. But the fact of the matter was, I think that because the black business community had a kind of this relationship with the white business community, he had these black business people also supporting him. And that may have helped him as well, because many black newspaper men and women, you know, in the South during this period and prior to this, you know, suffered immensely. I mean, if you go back to the late 19th century, Ida B. Wells was the editor of the Memphis Free Speech. You know, when she wrote about the lynchings of her friends who had operated a grocery store in competition with a white grocer, and they were lynched, she was essentially forced out, you know, left and went to Chicago. So, and that was not the only case. So African-American journalists, especially in the South, had to be incredibly courageous. And Austin absolutely was. He was fearless by almost all accounts.
And then during World War II in particular, Austin is not only navigating local backlash and pressures from whites within Durham and North Carolina, but also he comes under increasing surveillance on a national level. And you talk in the book about the FBI and also the IRS relentlessly auditing the Carolina Times. So how exactly did national agencies or national forces try to curtail or to push back against Austin during that period?
Yeah, he was under FBI surveillance. It's interesting from the standpoint of sources. I mentioned that the newspaper that were microfilmed started in 1937, but they were not. It's not a complete run. So they were. I think it was almost no newspapers available from 1944 through 48. but I ordered the FBI file on Austin, which was fairly thick. He was under surveillance throughout World War II. And the FBI, I think, did a pretty good job of copying down his editorials. And so they had a number of his editorials from the 1940s when they had him under surveillance, which were ended up being pretty good sources of what Austin was trying to do during that time and challenging, injustice during that period. But the FBI had him under surveillance. His daughter told me that they were being wiretapped during that period. The FBI actually, there was a danger that the FBI would suppress the black press almost across the board. And so the FBI was surveilling the post office. There were surveillance of many black newspapers during that period. Only, as it turned out, only a few small papers were confiscated. They weren't allowed to use the mails to send their newspapers. But at some point, the FBI backed off. And I think at the behest of the Attorney General, and a decision was made not to suppress the black press, because the federal government saw the black press as stirring up black opposition to federal policies and causing division within the war. And of course, all the black press was asking for is for the federal government to treat African Americans equally. And, you know, if you can imagine, many African Americans were not too keen on fighting for the United States Army, United States government, supposedly to spread democracy around the world, when they faced such an entrenched system of racial oppression and denial of democracy. During this period, as I mentioned, throughout the South, African Americans were regularly denied the right to vote. It was a situation where the federal government wanted to keep any type of opposition to as small as possible. But Austin refused to back down. Some newspapers actually, after meeting with federal government officials, did kind of temper their editorial stance. But Austin refused to do so. And you can see that in the editorials. He was very strongly during World War II in support of the March on Washington movement, which was a movement started by A. Philip Randolph, African-American labor leader, leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Randolph was trying to, he was challenging racial segregation in the armed forces, but also trying to get President Franklin Roosevelt to issue an executive order ending racial discrimination in employment at defense contractors. And Austin was one of the few black leaders or activists who supported that movement in North Carolina. So he also was the biggest supporter of the Double V campaign, which was a campaign popularized by the Pittsburgh Courier, which was to, yes, support U.S. efforts against the Axis powers in the war, but also to fight for victory against racial oppression at home. So in other words, not to defer the movement against racial injustice till after the war, which some African Americans, including W.E.B. Du Bois, did in World War I.
And then the Double V campaign and African American activism during World War II really sets a platform for the emergence of the post-war black freedom struggle. So as you eloquently detail in your book, for Austin, this is a struggle that he's been actively involved in for most of his life. But what happens post-World War II, and how specifically does Austin use the Carolina Times to give voice or a platform to that developing struggle, either in North Carolina or on a national level?
Yeah, the post-war, I mean, as you say, World War II was a pivotal era in terms of the Black Freedom Movement, the March on Washington movement, which is a predecessor to the more famous 1963 March on Washington, which was also organized, at least in part, by A. Philip Randolph. And post-World War II, the period, the kind of nine-year period prior to the Brown versus Board of Education decision, was also incredibly important. In 1945, Austin ran for the city council. And that was the first time an African American had run for the city council in Durham in the 20th century. He didn't win, but it was important because it kind of mobilized the black electorate. During this period, black voting was increasing. And by the late 1940s, African Americans joined with liberal whites and labor activists in Durham to form Voters for Better Government. And the Voters for Better Government was kind of a black liberal white coalition. And Austin was quite supportive of that movement And that movement actually led to the election of R.N. Harris, who was a black businessman who was elected to the city council in Durham in 1953, you know, which is significant because that's 12 years before the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. So African-Americans were becoming increasingly influential in terms of politics. In 1947, the same year that Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Major League Baseball, Austin organized the first integrated football game, the first integrated football game in the South, according to most sources, when he organized a football game between a black team from Washington, D.C., and a white team from Philadelphia that was played right in Durham. He was also continuing to work with the Durham Committee on Negro Affairs and also a statewide group called the North Carolina Committee on Negro Affairs, which was increasing the number of African Americans elected. So even when blacks were not elected, they were getting more sympathetic whites elected to either city office or sometimes to statewide office. You know, some people have said that North Carolina was more moderate, or some would say more progressive. I mean, I wouldn't support that view, but they were in some ways more moderate than some deep South politicians. And I think part of that, a good part of that, may be the increasing black vote, which was able to elect some, you know, less virulent racists to public office. So he continued to be quite active in the late 40s and early 50s in voting rights. He also promoted desegregation of buses. There were a number of challenges, even going back to the 1930s, where often African-American women refused to move to the back of buses, and he supported them. There was a case of someone who's well-known here in Durham in North Carolina, a woman named Pauli Murray, who was a black attorney who was very pivotal in the civil rights struggle, women's rights movement. And she was a friend of Louis Austin. In fact, she worked for the newspaper when she was quite young. And Pauli Murray was on a bus in Petersburg, Virginia. And at one point, she refused to stay in the back of the bus because I think one of the seats was broken, and she was arrested. And Austin wrote about her and backed her resistance to bus segregation. So he was working through a lot of avenues, challenging segregation. Of course, he was also challenging segregation in schools, both the higher education and primary and secondary schools as well. In 1951, a case was brought by a number of African Americans called Blue versus Board of Education, which was not an integration case. It was a case challenging the inequality of black schools in the Durham public school system. And the case actually was successful in 1951. In fact, if that case had become an integration case, some locals argue that instead of Brown versus Board of Education being known as the landmark case, it would have been Blue. So Austin was moving along a lot of different fronts during that period.
And one thing that Austin really characterizes his adult life is not just his political activism and his role in political organizing, but also his political independence. So during the 40s and into the 50s and 60s, he's, you know, he affiliates and disassociates himself from different political parties, whether it's the Progressive Party or the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. How does Austin understand party politics, do you think, and how does he strategically try and use different party platforms to advance black rights?
Yeah, Austin's focus, of course, was racial equality and racial justice. So he supported the political party that he felt would give the best chance for that. So as I mentioned, in 1932, he broke from the Republican Party and supported the Democratic Party. And the Durham Committee on Negro Affairs, as I mentioned before, they generally would support the Democratic Party through that period and even later. But in 1956, Austin broke with the Democrats and supported the Republicans, because in the aftermath of the Brown versus Board of Education decision, this movement by Southern white supremacists to, you know, I think it was called Massive Resistance, to resist public school integration. And so these white Democrats in the South, including those in North Carolina, their primary focus was to challenge segregation or challenge integration. And so Austin basically had enough of these white politicians in North Carolina and the South. And even at the presidential level, when Adlai Stevenson, who was known as sort of a liberal Democrat, but on the issues of the South and, you know, Southern Democrats, he did not speak out against segregation. So Austin decided to reject the Democratic Party at that point, and he backed the Republican Party. In fact, he was present at the inauguration of Dwight D. Eisenhower for president in 56. So one of his friends, a history professor at what was then North Carolina College named Helen Edmonds, became the first African-American to second the nomination of a presidential candidate at a nominating convention when she seconded the nomination of Eisenhower. And Austin and his wife actually went to the inauguration. But he didn't stay really with the Republican Party consistently after that. So it depended on who was running, who was a candidate. In 1960, for example, the Carolina Times supported Terry Sanford, who was a Democrat. Of course, during this period, as I mentioned, Republicans had no chance to win statewide office in North Carolina. So it was still the case in the late 50s and early 60s if whoever won the Democratic primary was going to be the winning candidate in the general election. But Terry Sanford in 1960 ran for governor as a more moderate Democrat, even though he still backed segregation of public schools for the most part and supported the efforts by the General Assembly to keep the schools for the most part segregated. But he was he wasn't the virulent racist that his opponent, a guy named I. Beverly Lake, was, who was more like someone like George Wallace of Alabama, who was the guy who said segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. So he would support moderate Democrats into the 60s, and he supported President Johnson in 64. To go back a little bit, you mentioned the Progressive Party in 1948. Austin and a number of people in Durham, a number of black activists in Durham, supported Henry Wallace, who had been Harry Truman's vice president and had been a secretary of commerce before that. Wallace had come out strongly against segregation. And so Austin supported Wallace, and he actually ran for a state representative on the Progressive Party platform. So he looked for, you know, the most strategic way he could to try to buttress the Black Freedom Movement. And so he was at times a Democrat, at times a Republican, and at times a progressive. In fact, when he was a Republican, he was able to use his influence in the Republican Party to get African Americans hired as postal workers in Durham at the post office. So he was, you know, he was number one looking for, you know, the fight for racial justice. And, you know, whichever party he felt could move that forward, he was going to support that one.
And into the 60s, as the movement's starting to change, strategies or tactics are starting to change. So North Carolina, Greensboro, of course, is the beginning of the sit-in movement, or at least that's how it's commonly recognized. Where does Austin sit within these generational tensions that we often see between a more established but perhaps more conservative old guard of the NAACP and other organizations who prefer to take the legal or political approach, and then a younger generation who are more connected to direct action, direct protest in a different sense?
You know, Lewis Austin, certainly bridged the generational gap, because he really joined with this new generation of young college students and even sometimes high school students who emerged in the 1960s. And even really before that, in 1957, Austin was one of the few black leaders, or at least older black leaders in Durham, who backed the Royal Ice Cream sit-in, which was a sit-in that was led by a pastor in Durham named Reverend Douglas Moore. And he and six young black men and women mounted a sit-in at an ice cream parlor in which the facilities were segregated in 1957. And he was one of the few. The Durham Committee on Negro Affairs opposed that sit-in. They felt it was too much at that time, too fast, that Durham wasn't ready for it. And Austin, in fact, a story that was told to me by one of the Royal Ice Cream Seven, as they were called, a woman named Virginia Williams, who participated in that sit-in, as she told me that Austin As soon as he heard about the sit-in, he rushed down to the jailhouse to try to bail out the seven who were arrested. And he was very disappointed when somebody else got there before him to bail him out. But he became a confidant and an advisor to many of the young protesters in the 60s after the Greensboro sit-in started on February 1st of 1960, you know, led by the four young students from North Carolina A&T. Austin was asked, the students at North Carolina College in Durham, they were had heard about it, and they were planning a sit-in the following week. They were going to start it on February 8th. And one of the leaders, one of the student leaders went to Austin, who they knew, and asked him for advice. And he told them to definitely go through with it and move forward. And, of course, they did. And that sit-in by the Durham students, you know, I would argue was very important, because if you think about a sit-in becoming a movement, if the first sit-in is important, but if others don't follow, there's no movement. The Royal Ice Cream sit-in is not remembered today by many because it was a one-off sit-in. There was not a follow-up. In other words, people in Greensboro and Raleigh and other cities didn't follow. But in the case of the Greensboro sit-ins in February of 1960, within a week, students in Durham, students in Raleigh, from other Black colleges like Shaw University and St. Augustine's University, they continued. So the sit-in spread to cities across North Carolina and eventually cities around the South. And it, you know, kind of reestablished the movement, which had been, some would argue, in a period of kind of stasis in the late 50s. So that was particularly important. Also in the 1960s, Austin published the names of white businesses that refused to hire African Americans as clerks. And this was part of a boycott. And so the community knew who to boycott, and this put pressure on these businesses. And once they would hire, and they did start to do that. And of course, you could trace this back to the 1930s when Austin had been leading protests by African Americans to boycott the grocery stores in Durham that didn't hire African Americans, and actually succeeded in getting stores like A&P and Kroger's to hire black employees in the early 1930s and mid 1930s. So Austin was very involved in the 1960s as an advisor to many of the students. In fact, many of the students didn't feel they had much support among the older Black leadership. But Austin was one who was absolutely they could count on. There were others, too. John Wheeler, who was a businessman and became the president of the Mechanics and Farmers Bank and also the head of the Durham Committee. By that time, the Durham Committee was becoming more supportive and did support the 1960s sit-ins.
So Austin is clearly a quite strong ally to younger students and activists involved in the sit-in movement and other direct action protests during the early 60s. But his relationship in the last 5 or so years of his life to the emergence of Black power is a little bit more complicated. So could you speak to that?
Yeah, Austin would editorialize against the Black Panther Party, for example, and even SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. When SNCC became more Black power oriented and more Black nationalist oriented by the late 60s, Austin was not a separatist or a nationalist. He did not support nationalism. He was an integrationist. And he also spoke out against the use of violence. So he was opposed to armed self-defense. Well, you know, this is also complicated because he was someone who's defended himself, as you mentioned in one of your questions, when Austin defended his wife when you know, on a street in downtown Durham. He was not averse to self-defense personally. I mean, there was actually another case where he went down to one of the sit-ins. He went down to one of the sit-ins in 1960 at Woolworth with one of his friends, a journalist named Alex Rivera, photographer and journalist named Alex Rivera. And they went down to the sit-in to see, and when they got there, and this is from Rivera's recollection, they sat there, a couple of seats at the lunch counter that were vacant. And so Austin said, "Let's sit down." So Austin sat down, and almost immediately, one of the white segregationists who was there poured something hot on Austin's head, coffee or soup or something. And Austin jumped up, started yelling and said, "You see those guys over there on that end and those on the other end? They're nonviolent. I'm violent as hell." And nothing actually happened. You know, they left. I think Rivera got him out of there. But personally speaking, Austin would not, you know, was not averse to defending himself. And of course, that was the case with many civil rights activists. Even, you know, many have pointed out that nonviolence was often a tactical stance, not necessarily a philosophical stance, although it was philosophical for some and tactical for some as well. But Austin did oppose, as I mentioned, the Black Panther Party, and he felt like that was not the way to go. But on the other hand, there was a local leader named Howard Fuller, who was quite close to Austin. And Fuller was seen as a Black Power advocate in Durham, and someone who spoke using the rhetoric of, you know, more militant or more violent, or at least violence in the, you know, in terms of self-defense. And he would say those types of things like, "We're not going to turn the other cheek," or, "The next time someone attacks us, we're not going to turn the other cheek and you'll see a fist." And Austin was very supportive of Fuller. And, you know, he was an advisor to Fuller. Howard Fuller told me that Austin, you know, was one of the leaders who he looked to for support. And when Fuller was under attack, you know, for some of the things he said or some of the things he did, Austin would come to defend him very quickly. So some have said that Austin, you know, just opposed, you know, Black Power or the younger generation or in the late 60s. But I think that's, as you said, it's more complicated than that.
And Austin, he passes away in 1971. What kind of impact does his passing have in terms of the Carolina Times specifically, but also the Black community within Durham and across North Carolina?
Well, it absolutely was a huge loss to the movement, both in Durham and throughout the state. It was a huge loss for the Carolina Times, obviously a huge loss for his family. But after Austin died, the paper didn't die. The paper would continue to flourish. In fact, some people have argued that, you know, with the coming of integration, and of course it is true that many Black institutions were not able to survive. If you think about the Negro leagues in terms of baseball, you know, some Black businesses, but Austin's newspaper, the Carolina Times, was then taken over by his daughter, Vivian Edmonds. And if you look back at the papers in the 70s and 80s, she really followed through on his, you know, his program. The motto of the paper was "The Truth Unbridled," and she continued to give them the truth. And she continued to support the continued movement in the 70s. I mean, in fact, in the late 70s, they had a kind of investigative pieces about police brutality, which was widespread then, just as it is today, against Blacks in many places throughout the country. She focused on Durham. She was also opposing, you know, by this time, urban renewal had devastated the part of the Black community known as Hayti. And she was holding out against, they were trying to get the newspaper to move and sell their business so they could build the Durham Freeway, which runs through Durham and actually ran through the Black community. And in 1978, a fire occurred at the Carolina Times and burned the building to the ground. By all accounts, it was likely arson. And she believed, this is Vivian Edmonds, Lewis Austin's daughter who was running the paper, she believed that it was a result of the pieces they were doing on police brutality and perhaps their resistance to moving from their building or sell their building to the urban renewal authorities. The paper continued to flourish. In fact, the paper, and economically, I think business-wise, it was doing pretty well because the newspaper had grown to was about 16 to 24 pages by that time, which is an indication that they were able to get advertising to support it. After she gave up, she retired, and her son, Kenneth Edmonds, ran the paper. In fact, it's very sad. Kenneth Edmonds, who ran the paper from 2002 till this year, he passed away last month. And it's not clear that the paper will be able to continue. So the paper, which has been in the Austin Edmonds family since 1927, so for 93 years, and has been an amazing voice for the Black community, especially early on when many African Americans didn't have much opportunity to have their voice heard, but even today. And so many people in the community are trying to see if they can get the Carolina Times back up and running.